So I see a lot of developmental biologists in the audience, but I guess about half of you are not developmental biologists. Is that right? Okay, so what I'm going to do is present some developmental biology that we've been working on, which involves waves and oscillators. And 2 weeks ago, we heard from the LIGO team about the role of gravitational waves. Today, it's got something to do with embryonic waves. And the one sort of key take-home message, if you like, that you can get from today is the origin of your backbone. So I notice most of you are not wearing any fancy exoskeletal suits, so you presumably used your backbone to get in here. You're familiar with it, but I wonder how many of the non-developmental biologists in the room know how it got made and what the events were in the embryo that produced this beautiful array of bones regularly shaped all the way down your back. Production of a repeated anatomy is one of the classes of developmental biology problems that are called segmentation. Okay, so that's what I'm going to be talking about today. And to give you some... Boris and Madhav offered that I could show a film, so I'm sort of... I'm aware that that's slightly non-standard, and I'm very honoured. I'll show you a picture of a zebrafish embryo, and most of what I talk about today is focused on zebrafish. Much of it is general to all vertebrates. And this is a zebrafish embryo. What you can see is the yolk in the middle. These are all the nutrients that the fish will use for the first 4 or 5 days of development till it can start to feed with its own mouth. It grows very quickly. You see a band of cells, embryonic cells, in a crescent shape on top of the yolk. This is looking from the side, so if you could imagine the animal is sitting like this over the yolk. Its eye will grow here. And what I'd like you to focus on as its body axis extends is what happens along its back. And you'll be seeing a transgenic animal, which is an animal that carries fluorescently tagged genes, proteins that we put into it, that will illuminate two patterns of gene expression as the animal grows. A red one, which will mark each of the newly forming blocks of cells that will give rise to each one of the bones down your back. And then I want you to cast your steely gaze on this posterior tissue here in the tail and look at what the cells are doing there. Those cells are not, in this movie, not yet arranged into these blocks of cells, these segments. You see these blocks of cells being formed, one after the other, all the way down the back. As each of these blocks is forming, you can see its border is marked with a row of red cells. So there's a particular gene that's being switched on in those cells. And now, when we look in this is the tail bud now, what I want to draw your attention to is the appearance of waves that are sweeping through that tissue, starting in the posterior, moving anteriorly. Their wavelength shortens, they slow, and then they arrest. And where those waves stop, that predicts the time and the position of each newly forming block of cells. So we call this astonishing activity back here the segmentation clock. Some sort of oscillatory system ticking in the tail of the animal that seems to be producing this beautiful array of cells that will give rise to your backbone. Okay. That's all I want to do. I want to show you what it actually looks like in an embryo. Are you a developmental biologist?
Yes, I know. What's the time? I think I know. What's the time?
It depends on the temperature, actually, but approximately a new segment forms every 30 minutes. That's a good time scale to hold in your head. Each segment is approximately 50 microns across. And so we're looking at an embryo that has dimensions perhaps around 1 millimeter in total. Okay, let's eject the fish. Okay, so there's a lot of cells here, and before that movie started, we had some very basic developmental biology. So I'm going to give you the 2-minute primer on developmental biology to make sure that when we start to talk about the segmentation clock, we're all at the same point. So I think we'd say that development starts with an egg and a sperm. So that's maybe to scale for some species. Probably the sperm's a lot smaller. Fertilization is when the sperm gets in the egg and a new diploid organism with 2 sets of chromosomes is triggered, started. Now, the first thing that happens is, so there's 2 things that are going to happen. The basic units, if you like, of starting development are cell division. So this thing will divide into 2 cells, then 4, 8, 16, and so forth. So the divisions are not always synchronized, but this is a good way to start. Many animals do it exactly this way. So that's proliferation. That's the word we use to describe the cell division. And then other things start to happen too. The first one is, another one is differentiation. And that is that some cells use cues either through some sort of symmetry breaking cues, either inherited from mother or calculated from the local environment, to mark themselves as being different. They express different genes. One of the ways we mark them as being differentiated, they also have different shapes or different movements. And then at some point, growth can happen, which is where instead of the cells getting smaller as divisions happen, the embryo uses its energy resources to grow a cell and divide it, grow a cell and divide it, so that the net volume of the embryo can start to change. And then the cells can rearrange. They can flow, they can buckle, they can change their arrangement. And so I'm just drawing here now. I'm going to put some sort of time step, and then we'll put an embryo that has started to elongate, elongating in this direction. You can see that it's thinned in that direction. That squeezing is the internal shear of all those cells elongates the animal. And it's leaving behind some sort of differentiated pattern.
What determines the direction in which it elongates? Is it the matrix of a mother or whatever?
It can be. It can be that the mother gives some clue as to which direction will be head and tail. So that can be. In some other animals, it's not so clear that the mother does give any clue, and that the signals then are perhaps broken by the animal in some other way. The symmetry is broken by the animal in some way. So we would say, but to sort of, at some point, so let's say the cause of symmetry breaking is not always known, but very quickly it becomes possible to find, let's say, supposed to be a GF, some marker or some molecule activity like a growth factor that sets up some polarity across the tissue. So I'm going to talk about these in a sense. That's a good question.
Just about the growth, the increase in volume, does, for example, in the fish, does it absorb liquid, like H2O from outside? Because while it can make structures, it has to have water in its cells. And does it absorb that from the outside, or the total volume of the egg is the same, it's just converting from yolk to cells?
I'm not sure that's been measured with enough precision to know where the extra volume is coming from. That's a good question. Cells can actively take up water, and they can move out water too. It usually costs some energy to do so, but that's certainly a possibility. Okay, so now, developmental biology in a nutshell. So now at this stage in my sort of diagram here, I've got thousands of cells, thousands of cells packed in a matrix, and now I'm going to draw up here what I consider our sort of tissue outline that is important for understanding this process of segmentation that you saw in the movie that just went by. Okay, so give it an axis. This is, we would call that posterior or the tail. Its head would be up here somewhere. They do have a nose, but it doesn't look like that. Here are the most recently formed segments. So if you remember from that movie, that one just formed, that one formed half an hour ago, and that one half an hour before that. And so this, here we have a tail bud. So there would be various growth factors, which we just talked about, marking this polarity. And the animal is actively extending. It doesn't matter whether it's extending by proliferating new cells on the end or by the rearrangement of tissue, like I described here. This interval here is of interest to us because it's this interval where the waves are sweeping across, and it's their arrest at some position here which appears to be giving the tissue the information about where to make the next segment. So we care about this area, and as each new segment forms, those cells are removed from the main bulk of the tissue and new cells are added across this boundary here. So we've got some flux of cells through this reference frame. That becomes important. I'm going to try and break this down into three levels of description. And the first one is single cells. And so we're looking at about 10 micrometers. Then I want to ask what happens when there is some sort of local coupling between the cells. So now we're looking at, you know, let's say 20, two cells in the simplest case. And finally, I want to go up to the scale of even 500 micrometers and talk about the global pattern, the waves that we see. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, that could be because I haven't actually said anything. Okay, so, righto.
When these waves form, has the animal already produced a primitive gastric tract?
Not yet.
Yeah.
It starts before the... it's made some of the tissue that will end up making the gut.
Yeah.
But it's present as a thin layer of individually motile cells. Mm-hmm. They're still wandering around the embryo at that point, looking for where they're going to make the tube.
Uh-huh.
The tube won't complete until about a day after.
Yeah.
So, okay. Let me start. So, how should we think about these waves sweeping across the tissue? We could think that they might be something like an acoustic or an optic wave, some sort of transmission of energy. Could be some sort of trigger wave that runs across the tissue. There's a really interesting experiment that we've just been able to do, which suggests, which is consistent with some older embryological experiments. I think the simplest way to consider this is to ask the question, what happens if we get a single cell out of the tissue? Can it oscillate or can't it? So this is a basic question about the tissue. So we'll go to single cells now. And I'm going to draw a little, I'm going to draw an experiment. The gene I'm going to call C, and it corresponds to the C for cyclic or clock, and it corresponds to the green wave patterns that you saw on that tissue movie. So we, that gene is, I'm going to show the signal now, we get a time axis, and we can see in an individual cell, we can see that the cell continues to oscillate in culture. In fact, even when it's a single cell sitting in a well with no other cells around at all. To get it to do this persistent and noisy behavior, we need to give it a growth factor. So in some sense, we're tricking it, I think, I would claim, into thinking that it's still back here. Okay, so an oscillating cell plus growth factor would be what we call an autonomous oscillator. So what is it that's oscillating? And I think I need to give you some more intuition about that. So I think I'll go as basic as I can, because it never hurts, and often kills me when I'm making a mistake. Okay, this is a very interesting polymer called DNA, famous for storing genetic information. Genes are sequences of the polymeric pieces along the double strands. When a gene is what we call expressed, it's copied into a single strand nucleic acid molecule called RNA. And then That RNA is copied again, but now the alphabet's changed into protein. Okay, so you've, this is biochemistry 1. And this is known as the central dogma of molecular biology. Okay, so now that's not going to oscillate, but in when we look at this protein, this gene C, clock gene, what we see biochemically, we and other groups, when I say we, I'm going to be general here, we see that these proteins can bind to their own genes and switch off their expression. So in sort of the simplest way, you could make transcription and translation. We've now completed a negative feedback loop. And if the timescales of production and the half-lives of the molecules are balanced, then in principle, this system can give rise to sustained oscillations. And so that is the current model in the field for the oscillatory circuit. You could call this a genetic circuit inside individual cells in the tissue. This kind of protein we'd call a transcription factor because it can regulate the transcription or expression of genes. Okay, so...
Andy, can I ask a naive question?
Yeah.
Of all the gene-producing, protein-producing genes in the cell, yeah. How many act like, what percentage act like this? That is, that the protein acts back or is somehow involved in the in a loop on the sequence itself.
Right, so let me complete that over here and say that this could be positive, giving rise to a positive feedback, or in the case that I'm talking about, it could take it shut it down. So the number of transcription factors in a metazoan genome like us is hundreds that are known, and maybe there are other molecules that are binding to the genome which we don't know about yet. Hundreds? More? Does anyone
know? Vertebrates, it's reckon 15 to 18.
Quite a... Okay. Nearly thousands.
It's half like 780-ish.
Okay. 100 is not too bad.
Okay.
Actually, pull that one.
Out of how many?
A thousand, and how many proteins?
Out of, on the order of tens of thousands. Yeah. So maybe 10% of the genome can do this. And I think that is part of the way that biologists, developmental biologists, think of how these... One of the ways that these events are coordinated is by these, not necessarily entirely self-referential, but you could imagine a graph with these connections broadening and different activities in it. And so, in some sense, what I'm doing is I'm saying, to understand this problem, we need to focus down on a very, very simple part of that gigantic graph. In the case of the segmentation plot, we think that there might be no more than a handful, perhaps two or three in each vertebrate, of this kind of direct feedback genes. There are other genes that oscillate in control of this gene, and I'm going to talk about one of them in just a second.
How do you get the oscillation, actually? I mean, you have to turn it off.
Sorry?
But how does it start again?
So this is important. This protein has a short half-life. On the order of tens of minutes. Actually, we've measured the ones in fish, and they have a half-life of about 12 minutes. So when this switch is off, those proteins degrade quite quickly, and then it's open for business. Of course, we need some positive input into that signal as well, but I just left that off for simplicity. Now, I'm just going to come back to the half-life because I think it's really interesting. The key things I want to say now are that when we look at individual cells, they're noisy. They're actually much noisier than the rhythm that we see in the tissue together. The period is longer than the period we see in the tissue. It's quite a bit longer. But we do think that these are important because if we make mutations or we block one of the steps in this feedback loop, what we can see is, now I plot here, and then we see, we lose oscillations. So that doesn't tell us that this feedback loop is basic oscillatory drive, if you like. It could be that there's oscillatory information coming through this that needs to be processed or damped or amplified or act as some filter, but at least it tells us that this is an essential way, it is an essential part of the mechanism. One of the reasons why I'm a bit hesitant about saying that this is the heart of the clock is that up to now, nobody's been able to deliberately engineer changes in this circuit and come up with a stable oscillator that runs for developmental periods that are interesting for developmental process. So let's say over a day or something. So for example, by changing the half-life, you can change the period in the short term, but then the oscillator crashes and gives a signal like this. So nobody has yet really been able to reach in and tune it and say, okay, here's the new period. And so I think until we can do that, basically it will, I think we need to be just a little bit cautious. So that's an open question. Is this really the heart of the clock? Okay.
Can I just ask, what do you actually measure?
Yeah.
So the C is a function of time, that's a real measurement.
Yeah.
And
what are we actually doing?
Yeah.
We put these individual cells on a microscope slide in a fluorescence microscope,
mm-hmm.
and then we record the photons coming from their fluorescence protein
as the
amount of this fluctuates in time,
mm-hmm.
and we record them on a EMCCD camera, for example.
Yeah.
And that's what this trace is here.
Yeah. So it depends upon the fluorescence protein having its production coupled to the transcription regulating protein in some way.
Super question. In fact, we cheated. We put the fluorescence protein as a direct fusion onto that protein, so there's no escape.
Okay.
We're not coupling it to another system. It is, we tag that one directly.
Does the oscillation period depend on the temperature?
Yes, it does. It has a Q10 of about 2.8. So when we go from 20 degrees, the animals are pretty happy to grow at 20, and they're also happy to grow at 30. The frequency of somite production goes up threefold. Amazingly, the animal looks, to all intents and purposes to us from our movies, identical. We cannot tell which temperature we grew it at. So that must mean that the temperature sensitivity of these other processes of growing are coupled with the rate increase of this cycle. That's a good question. That's another very, very good question about how, in fact, that happened. We don't have a clue.
So you mentioned that this probably starts with a growth factor, which is at the one side of the polarity. So there are two time scales here which are important for the wave.
Yes.
Like here. One is the half time of the protein, and the other one is the diffusion time scale for the growth factor.
Okay. Really good. Yes. Remember that we're going to come back to the activity of growth factors at one end. The diffusivity of those growth factors might not be the timescale that we're interested in, but I agree there needs to be some other timescale associated with that tissue length. Okay, that's good. Let's see if I can come back and answer that. And if I don't, remind me. All right, I'd like to jump up to two cell. I'd like to jump up to local coupling. If there are no objections, Your Honour. So of course, this is a very small part of a larger graph. And what I'm going to now say, well, let's bring this. There are many, many copies of this in the cell. And so, in fact, they bind to other proteins as well. Other genes, as well. And here's a new gene, and this I'm going to call S for signal. And so just imagine that you have every time this goes around once, it delivers a periodic repression onto this other target gene. So now we're expanding the graph out a little bit, and now I want to draw a new diagram, which is two cells. So this cell has an oscillator of this kind in it, and this cell also has a similar oscillator. Now, this cell is going to, every time that biochemical cycle goes once, it's going to make a signal molecule on its surface. Don't worry about the real name of that molecule, but we have a very good idea of what it is. And it remains bound to the surface. This is the key here. This one can't diffuse away. And all of the cells in this tissue are studded with a receptor,
for that signal. And so when these two interact, when they bind, a portion of this molecule, I won't cloud with too much biochemical detail, actually can bind to this promoter. So this, now I'm extending the graph, and what I'm doing is I'm making another loop. Can you see that? The loop is completed in another cell. And now the time, and it can influence the local frequency and the phase of this oscillator. So now this one sends back a signal, its own, and that completes what we believe is the mutual coupling loop that the cells in the tissue can express. For a signal, ubiquitous receptors, and periodically pulsing signals. One cell diameter range, but of course you imagine these cells, they're surrounded by neighbors, with some sort of local coupling. And so you're going to ask, what happens when... So remember I pointed out that the individual oscillators were noisy. If you remember the movie, what you saw was quite a coherent wave pattern. And in fact, when we mutate one of these proteins, I'm going to do another... when we either mutate one of those proteins or block this transmission, two different ways we can do it, it gives the same results. If we take... now, the oscillators, instead of oscillating together, they continue to oscillate, but let me... They now show no temporal correlation with their neighbours. They become more noisy, and they lose the temporal synchronization with their local neighbours. Now, what I should do at this point, I've given you two kinds of breakages. We can break the internal clock here, or we can break the coupling here. In both cases, we end up with big problems over here. So I'm going to sketch these in. We lose the waves that sweep through this tissue, and the boundaries that end up forming on this end are spatially disordered. They can be in different orientations, and my guess is that they are very local reactions of cells sticking to each other, and they don't reflect, so they're not reflections of a new coherent order, but rather the loss of a global order of having the waves. And if you're an embryo and you make your somites like that, you will develop a birth defect called scoliosis. So this matters to the animal. It matters that this runs because the several things will go wrong if you have scoliosis, but of course primarily it's locomotion. For a fish, they swim poorly, they're neutrally buoyant, so they can still float around. And actually if they're in a research aquarium, we don't try and eat them, and we give them lots of food. So they actually can survive and breed, but if you put them in a swimming trial, you can see that they're hopeless. Which means that if they were chasing food or being chased, they would be the first to be eaten. It's worse if you're a dry vertebrate like us and you try and balance the weight of your skull on a backbone that looks like a corkscrew, because it will compress it. I'm not going to talk any more about that, but if you're interested, you can look that up on Wikipedia or something and see what happens. It's not pretty. Okay, so we've got these two levels of single cell and local coupling. And now I want to go up to the global pattern.
What is the timescale of this signal?
That's a super question. So we've estimated this timescale at being about two-thirds of the period, from two-thirds to three-quarters of the period. And that's interesting because many of you, I'm sure, are familiar of a large body of work that's been done on synchronization of oscillators. One of the simplifications you can make is to say that the signals are instantaneous. This, you can do a lot if you do that. But if you say that the signal has a delay, then it introduces a new timescale into the dynamics. Mm-hmm. In fact, when these oscillators are synchronized, they're faster than when they're separated. And we think that's evidence that this timescale is finite and relevant. That's a really good question. So now let me do the last layer, and just shows you that time flies when you're having fun. Now I'm going to try and draw a chymograph, and I tried to draw this three times this morning, and I screwed it up each time, so let's see how we go. Remember the wave patterns in the tissue, and of course it's a bit confusing to know what's going on, because the tissue itself is moving, and you're trying to remember where was that wave, or was the thing, so the way to deal with that is, first of all, waves. Let's put a tissue axis here, and say if we've got waves, if we can see these stripes of gene expression, it must mean that we go round the clock of the oscillator more than once from one end to the other. There's a phase difference between the oscillators across that tissue. So if we put a phase, we would want to draw something like that. And I'm going to get killed if that's not straight, because that's what happened to me. I talked about that before. This phase distribution across the spatial extent of the tissue will give rise to travelling waves whose wavelength shortens as you move anteriorly. Okay. So I'm just going to leave that there as a way of thinking about the phase offset between neighbouring oscillators as they drift through the tissue. Now let's just go back now. Let's make a chymograph, same x. I'm going to put a time axis down here. Oops, not velocity. It's time. Okay, and then, okay, now I've got, as a wave comes out, it's something like that. Let's, just to, I don't screw myself up, putting previously emerged waves, I'm going to, now, something else was happening in that tissue. So this time space represents a wave moving, okay, and slowing down. You also remember, I hope, that the tissue shortened. The pre-Semitic mesoderm started out several hundred microns long and ends up about 150 microns at the end of the movie I just showed you. So now let me continue to do my... Okay, this is where it can get a bit nasty. Okay, so what I'm trying to do is give a representation of these waves moving across the tissue. Okay, now I've anchored this end at the tailbone, so right here, and I'm plotting the wave patterns as through time it grows and shortens like that, so the waves are moving continuously in that direction. Now, I ask you to make the assumption that the incoming wave provides the information for where to make the next segment. So there's a time signal that is going to be used about where to place the next segment. And if we put our, let's put our Maxwell's segmenta at this end of the pre-Semitic mesoderm and let them ride on the tissue frame, I think you can imagine what might be happening. It starts with a D. Any physicists? His first name was Christian. So what one sees is that, and this is where I'll see whether I screwed up the diagram, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, okay, so here's that's the time moving down. So when we measure, and this is now data, when we measure 7 oscillations in the posterior, we see that 8 have arrived in the anterior. And this sounds crazy because it sounds like we don't have a clock. One of the amazing things about clocks, or one of the sort of essential features of the clock, is that its period should be well-defined. But here I'm saying the period is not well-defined. It actually depends where you look at the clock as to what period you read. It's not mysterious, but it is a Doppler effect, and it's caused by this tissue boundary moving posteriorly through development. So here's a classical wave effect taking place in an embryonic tissue that's changing its length. And I don't think we would have seen it if the timescale of oscillations and the timescale of the velocity weren't so well matched. You could imagine if you're moving very, very slowly, the effect, I mean, it has to be there, but you'd never see it. You'd never see it at all. There's another effect that's going on in here that I'm not going to talk about today, but I'm happy to ask questions about it, which has to do with the internal change of the wavelength. Call it the dynamic wavelength effect. So there are two wave effects going on here that don't have anything to do with, they don't have anything to do with the details of these molecular networks. They have to do with the fact that this is a wave phenomenon. Okay, let's put a big D for Doppler. Thank you, Christian. And now, I want to just make one. So you say, well, okay, that's fine. What difference does it make? The difference that it makes, there's two differences. One is that the period with which the new segments are forming, which actually contributes to setting their length, is shorter at the anterior than the posterior. So that makes the segments shorter than they would have been if they were using this period. But the other thing is that a comment about the speed of the oscillators. So let me take a step back, go back up to this diagram. In order to get this falling phase, what the animal does is it regulates the frequency of cells across that tissue. It doesn't matter where the curve is relative to the white one. What matters is that the individual oscillators slow themselves as they drift through that reference frame. There's a slow cellular drift and a rapid phase wave. Okay, those are quite, there's about tenfold difference in the velocity of the cells and the phase waves. But that drift is real and it's important. So that the consequence is that if I look at an individual cell here, it's oscillating with the same frequency as the tissue. If I look at an individual cell here, it's oscillating very slowly. And yet the tissue frequency is high in the reference frame of this animal. So that means that you're forming, the animal is forming segments at a frequency that is higher than any of the constituent oscillators. That's pretty cool. I mean, that's a remarkable fact. I would put that in the remarkable fact category. So I just want to say one more thing, because I've mentioned that by breaking these links, we can get scoliosis. We've been recently playing with the wavelength, and we've shown that by tuning the slope here, the local wavelength, we believe we can tune the contribution of the Doppler effect and speed up segmentation even further. So that animal still makes good segments, so I don't think it gives rise to scoliosis, but it shows that by manipulation of the wave pattern, we can change a morphological output in the system. Okay. That concludes what I wanted to say. I'd be very happy to take any questions. Thanks very much for your attention.
So let's entertain some questions.
Yes, Will? I was just going to ask about, talk really about the longitudinal motion. What about in the transverse direction? Is there any dynamics?
So a cross axis? Yeah. Well, I don't think there's very much. In fact, nearly all of our models up to now have simplified the whole system as a one-dimensional array of oscillators. However, it's a three-dimensional tissue. And I think in order to understand the formation of the segments themselves as deformations of matter, we can't rely on a one-dimensional model. We probably can't rely on a two-dimensional model either. And that, for example, is what one of the groups is looking at this week in the course.
Is there any understanding of what turns off the process of segmentation and produces a finite number of vertebrae?
That's a really good question. I'd have to say not really, no. And in fact, it's not very well understood how the process is turned on in early development. So we can watch it both switching on and switching off, but at the moment I don't have anything concrete to say about that. There's another switching off as well, which is what happens to each of the oscillators as they get to this end of the tissue. So there might be, are these all the same bifurcations, just being crossed in different directions? Or is the system steering itself across different bifurcations depending on the time, the developmental time at which the event is happening? And I think we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
So here you have time scales, and you also have a length scale, which is like how big the tip of the tail is, right? I guess you can have fish of different sizes, longer and smaller fish. How can you reconcile that with this model?
Okay, so do you mean comparing, say, a zebrafish to a tuna, or to, say, let's say you take a clutch of zebrafish and you compare all the different sizes within the...
Yeah.
Okay, so that is a really good question.
Or you crop the embryo early and you cut it smaller fish or something.
This is a great question. This is something that developmental biologists have shown persistent interest in, and it's the question of scaling. The scaling of embryonic patterns. And to define that carefully, it really refers to changes in the initial conditions. If I start the embryo off with different sizes, what happens to the pattern? And there's nothing in this general model that couldn't provide scaling, but there's no insight into scaling from this model. It's totally compatible with it, but you need to, for example, what you could do, coming back to these growth factors, if you make the source of growth factors scale with starting size, then you can get the whole system to tune beautifully to the starting size. What I should point out, though, is that across developmental time, the system does not scale. So we started off with 6 pi here, 3 waves, and during development we end up with 1 pi phase difference across the system. So the internal pattern in that tissue during development, at least in zebrafish, does not scale. That's not just a compressed down version of the pattern. It's changing continuously. In fact, if it scaled, you couldn't possibly have a Doppler effect.
Has anyone done the fish equivalent of those frog experiments? I think it was a Cook Nature paper where you remove some of the material and you start with a smaller.
We have not done those experiments, but we would very much like to. And I think with these transgenic lines, we can. And the trick comes in taking out an equivalent amount of blastoderm and yolk, because you want to make everything a bit smaller. Otherwise, you've also changed the sort of proportions. We have a bottle of wine on offer for whoever can identify a mother that will lay different sized embryos. Because that would also be very nice if there was some...
Insulin-sensitive mutations. Insulin-sensitive pathway mutants. Will they do that? And flies will do it.
Okay, righto. That's a good hint.
Yeah, that was my question.
Oh, that was your question. Yeah. Has anyone tried the same sort of selection experiments that were done in Drosophila for generating a line with larger and a line with smaller? I mean, you must have some innate variation in size.
Yeah. No, not to my knowledge. I think that one of the disadvantages of zebrafish relative to other more tractable genetic systems like a Drosophila is that the time scale of the life cycle is equivalent to a mouse, which is, I guess, 3 to 4 months. And so that means that when you speak to an incoming grad school student about an experiment that will take the next 30 years, they say, you know what, I think I'll do a different project. So, but I think that's something that labs should be running in the background, right? Should just continually be selecting.
Like someone interested in this with their own lab. I mean, you can start now and in 20 years.
Yeah, I'll be retired. Okay.
Are these waves the trigger waves, or is this on the base wave?
It's a phase wave, it is not a trigger wave. And there's two, the easiest way to see that is that when you pull an individual cell out, it continues to oscillate. Another way to see it is some experiments that were done by Olivier Porquier's lab, and mind you, I should point out that his lab discovered these patterns, Isabel Palmerin discovered them in his lab.
What do you mean by a trigger wave?
A trigger wave. So my understanding of a trigger wave is where you have a system that... is not oscillatory, but it's very close to an oscillation, and a signal passed from one element of the media, excitatory, causes the trigger of the oscillations across the system. That's what you meant. So that doesn't look like it. Sorry, the other experiment I wanted to point out was if this tissue is chopped in half, then the waves in this half appear to continue for at least a couple more cycles. So there's... Or again, consistent with the fact that it can't be a obligatory transmission of signals. That doesn't mean that signals don't get sent between cells, they certainly do. But that's not the reason for the wave. The reason for the wave is that the individual cells gradually slow their frequency, and actually you can trick them into doing that in vitro as well.
What causes the slow of the frequency?
I didn't say anything about that, and I think that the most common model in the literature at the moment is that it has something to do with these growth factors, and I think that's a very plausible idea. But I think at the moment we don't really know, and a number of hypotheses are out there. Those gradients, maybe something internal in the clock, two different oscillators that gradually come into phase and stop each other, something like that. Or some sort of timer that the cells inherit as they leave the posterior, some sort of internal memory or maturation state that causes their oscillation.
So then, I remember you have the cultured cells, right, outside of the tissue. If you culture cells at the end or at the front, would you see different oscillation period?
So cells that you pull out of here have a different memory than the ones here.
Can you make a temperature gradient across this?
The temperature gradient was made, in Julian Lewis's lab, and he had two hot plates at slightly different temperatures, and then oriented the embryo along, across that gradient, and saw that the wave patterns on the two different sides were shifted relative to each other. So I think now would be a wonderful time to go back and redo that, watching the dynamics. Would be very cool.
There's a question over there. Does the fish always have the same number of segments?
Almost exactly the same number of segments. It's 34. So there are some fish that have 33 and some that have 35, but the majority have 34.
Can we reliably perturb the number of segments there?
We can. We have some ways of doing that. When we mutate one of these genes called HES6, we don't kill the clock. Others do, but this one doesn't. It slows it. The period of somitogenesis slows by about 7%, and that fish makes segments that are longer, and the total number of segments is fewer by exactly the same amount.
How many segments do humans have?
54? Yeah, 54. So actually, we've got more segments than this fish. The record holder for the number of body segments is probably the viper eel. They don't do what fish and humans do, which is to stop growing their segments at some point. They get to a certain stage in development and they fix their body anatomy. Viper eels keep growing. So it shows that that is possible. And I think 730 is the largest number. So that beats snakes and sharks. Go vipers.
So going back to the question about the role of the growth factor. So first question, is the total amount of growth factor integrated through the structure constant?
I have no idea. It's a very good question.
So, I mean, in terms of understanding what stops this process, have you tried, for example, adding growth factor to the end of the...
We have. Okay, so let me tell you about a class of experiments that we and other labs have done. They've been more successful when we've lowered the amount of growth factor. They work in the same way when you elevate the amount of growth factor, but the effects are smaller, and I can't tell you why. So here's the experiment. We let the animal start growing. We let it make, say, its first 10 segments, and then we transiently block signaling. We actually bind the growth factor with another protein so that it can't bind to its receptor. And then we see that there is a row of segments that form that are too large. And then when the perturbation goes away, the segment size goes back to being what it should be for that area of the body. So it's consistent with the level of signaling through that growth factor somewhere in the tissue being used to determine this length scale. How that works, I think it's a major question. And it's different labs reliably can get very similar results, but I think no one knows how that growth factor signaling talks down to this and stops it? It's a very good question. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds like it's a phrase of the gradient, but you don't know exactly how.
That's right. Way back, and then...
Yeah, and so maybe I should notice, or didn't, or maybe you said it. Is the phase difference between cells, so that's getting bigger as you
yes,
go.
Correct.
And so is that changing the coupling in the middle? Is there a change in that, the way that works?
Okay. The period between individual cells is also growing, so it's not so easy to say, and I don't have any experiments that will speak to that directly. I do know what happens if we block the coupling. We lose the coherent wave patterns and we lose segmentation. But if we follow the individual cells in the tissue that continue to oscillate, we see, go back to the other side, that they still slow down in the same way. So I don't know how it directly affects coupling in terms of synchronization, but I know that coupling is not responsible for the slowing. It could well have been, but it's not.
And is the phase difference leading to somatogenesis? Is the phase difference measured? The difference between the phase and two cells?
Neighbouring.
Yeah. Is that contributing to the decision to...
I have no idea. Yeah, it's a good question. I think that Alexander Aulela and also Paul Francois have been talking about models where a phase difference could potentially be measured by cells. And I think that's a very interesting idea, and I think you have to wait and see. There's no evidence from zebrafish, but there is some very intriguing results in the mouse that something like that might happen.
There were certain animals that can lose their tail and regrow it.
Yes.
Is it a link to
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's a... Yes, right. So they make a segmented tail, actually. The tail they regrow has segments, both of bone and muscle. But as far as anyone can tell, they do not make that tail via segment formation in the same way that they did during embryogenesis. So there's a completely new way to make a segmented tail. There's two tricks up the lizard's sleeve. And when you watch that, when you watch them growing, it looks... So I should say that the size of the muscle segments and the size of the bone segments is variable. And the number is variable. So when a lizard regrows its tail, it does so approximately. It's not a perfect copy of the original one, and the mechanism is quite different. And we could maybe talk about that in a bit more. There are people who know much more about that than me. Once I found out it wasn't oscillators, I just.
Is there a feeling for how general this model of segmentation is? Are there other completely different possible mechanisms?
Yeah, I think there's two answers to that. One is if you look in other phyla, so vertebrates seem to use something very similar to this. For a long time, we had thought that the arthropods, who are also segmented, insects and crustaceans, that they might be using a completely different mechanism that depended on very strongly on gradients and local transcription factor cascades. So not a sequential. But a more simultaneous way. The fruit fly Drosophila melanogaster, that's quite a derived, a local and derived mechanism to make segments. And I think now, and there's some of the world experts actually sitting here right now. When now the people are looking in other forms of arthropods, they are in general seeing some sort of clock mechanism, but with it's a theme in variation. And this, so you could ask, is the last segmented common ancestor, did they use a clock? And I think you would say, well, when I say clock, I mean oscillatory patterning mechanism. And I'd say the answer is yes. But when you look at the identity of the genes that are oscillating, they're nearly all different. And I think this comes back to the question that you asked about the number of transcription factors and the kinds of graphs you could make, for example, using repressors. I think it's not hard for organisms to come up with oscillators. And so maybe the clock is used as a mechanism, but it could be different clocks. Different clocks could evolve in different phyla. Okay, so the other answer to the question is, are there other theoretical mechanisms that could be used? Well, there's a real one in Drosophila that looks quite distinct, although it must have undergone an evolutionary transition at some point. But there are... there are local reaction diffusion type mechanisms of sort of Turing style that resurface repeatedly in an attempt to capture some of the solutions. And there are an interesting class which are purely mechanical, and maybe that will be the last thing I say because you probably want to get some oxygen, but this tissue here is mechanically active, and it must be. It's deforming, it's doing all sorts of interesting stuff. And there have been propositions that the emergence of these segments on this end of the tissue are analogous to a Rayleigh instability in a fluid. So surface tension could pinch these off. And so in that case, you would say, well, maybe the length scale here is a mechanical property of the tissue, maybe with some error. And maybe what all of these oscillatory activities doing is selecting the right length scale from a range of mechanically stable alternatives. So I think we don't know. I think it's still possible that that's true.
So on that note, let's thank Andy.